Are we live?
My sister-in-law was doing hair. My sister-in-law was doing hair for somebody at the Aria. Mm. And she was like, "What do you do for a living?" And the person was like, "Oh, I'm a hospitalist, you know?" Mm. And she was like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, she started asking questions, medical questions. She was like, "Are you in medicine?" To the hairdresser, like to my sister-in-law who's a hairdresser. And she was like, "Oh, no, my brother-in-law just works on, he works with this guy, Z-Dog, on Facebook. I don't know if you ever heard of him." And she was like, "Oh, Tom? Tom's your brother-in-law?"
We're so famous, Tom Heineberg. We're also live. Did you know that?
Hey, yo.
Just to supporters, mm-hmm. because everyone else can eat a bowl of dick.
That's how I feel about everybody who doesn't support.
It's true.
I like how everything's clarified online nowadays. It's like, yo, these are my supporters and these are my haters. Mm-hmm. There's a very clear dividing line.
Ain't nobody got time for them hoes, but we got time for you hoes because you hoes are subscribers. So me and Tom came to this epiphany, which I already intuitively felt, but he codified it. The cool, dope shit goes to supporters. Long form stuff, yep. stuff that you know the fans care about.
The real deal.
The real.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tiny
first
clips.
Things first. I'm the realist. Mm-hmm. What?
Oh, is that what's her
That's
name? The Australian
Iggy Azalea.
Azalea. Yeah, she apparently. So apparently, not only did she fall off, there were articles written about how she fell off and flamed out, and how she was all bullshit to begin with. And everybody was like, "I knew it." She's like the Liz Holmes of white rap.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought Liz Holmes was the Liz Holmes of white rap, but I was mistaken. Look at all our fans here, all the supporters. Katie Hodak listening on my headset whilst patients doing exercises. #Hashtag perks of HHPT.
Oh hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh hell yeah.
Oh K-ho. Can we call Katie mm-hmm. Hodak K-ho?
Can I tell you one of the only times I was in PT for my finger because I broke my finger playing Golden Tee, the virtual golf game, which is the whitest white privilege story you can have.
That's why you're our chief diversity officer here at Z-Dog MD.
That's true. I'm the CDO, chief diversity officer. Yeah. We're doing pretty good. I'm the only pure white here. Mm-hmm. Z is Indian.
Yes.
He's like sort of a weird Indian, like a Middle Eastern type Indian.
I'm a Windian.
You barely count, but mm-hmm. we'll count it.
We'll count it.
And Logan's half Mexican. So like we're doing great here at Z-Dog MD. We're 2/3 diverse.
By the way, speaking of that, Rachel Kinman, I like the way you quantified that, by the way. Like, that's what a good CDO does. Mm-hmm, well, according to my calculations.
You know, we're up to 66% diversity, although Logan is only half Mexican. We're going to count him as full
He's
Mexican.
He's partial black.
Though. That's right.
Yeah. And see, black is like a special, like, you get extra credit mm-hmm. in diversity.
See, I'm a pure, pure white, okay? I'm one of the good ones, all right? Because I signed my wife up for 23andMe, and she has what most Americans have, which is a typical, you know, European, you know,
yeah, just lineage,
broad cross section of all things European,
right?
And since my grandmother came here from Ireland, I'm pretty damn Irish. I'm like 90% Irish, basically.
Nice.
So yeah, it's pure.
The chances? Did you know
it's that pure uncut white privilege?
That is, speaking of uncut white privilege, the Irish being very inbred on a small island over mm-hmm. millennia. I have a very high rate of hemochromatosis, which is...
Damn straight.
Yep. And so you should get tested because I'm
Hell
pretty
no.
sure you look bronze as fuck right now.
You know what? You can cure that with whiskey. my grandmother was like a legit alcoholic. Mm. Legit.
Good time.
You know, she came by it honestly. Pure mm-hmm. Irish.
Pure Irish.
And when people started hassling her about her drinking later in life, she switched from whiskey to vodka so you couldn't tell when she was drinking because it would be clear in her glass.
See, that's good old fashioned.
She'd be like, "This is just club soda."
And listen, as chief diversity officer,
that's
you don't
true.
Call that alcoholism. You call that ethnic pride or
that's right.
cultural spin on something. Speaking of cultural spin, Rachel Kinman supporter says, "My 3-year-old just told me, quote, bag of dicks while eating his lunch. His dad will be excited. Welcome to the show, child of Rachel Kinman. Do not say bag of dicks to your dad unless you really mean it."
My wife, I was talking to my 4-month-old today, and my wife was talking behind me, and she's like, "I had this weird dream, but I can't remember what it was about. It was about somebody weird came to the door." And I'm talking to my daughter. I'm like, "Who was it? Who came to the door for mommy? Dildo salesman?" She's like, "Don't say dildo around her." I was like, "It's not like her first word is going to be dildo. If it does come out dildo, you'd be like, dildo."
And you just say, "Oh, she's saying daddy. That's her word
yeah,
for daddy.
That's
dildo.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell other people it's dad.
Oh, my gosh." So my 11-year-old came up with this nickname for me. It started as Doodlebug. Doodlebug Jones, actually. And now it's just Doodle. So in public, she'd be like, Doodle, get over here. I want this. I'm like, you're getting nothing, bitch. I'm not your Doodle. So it's very close to dildo.
Z has a real Rodney Dangerfield relationship with his children.
No respect.
No respect.
What was the movie Rodney Dangerfield made where he went back to college?
I think it's just called Back to School. That's a great movie.
It is.
And he joins the dive team.
Uh-huh, right. Mm-hmm. And he does, at the end, he does like the triple X gainer or whatever.
That's right, yeah.
He had nailed in college and no one believed him. Like, they were all like, you never did it, old man.
You know what I love about Rodney Dangerfield is he quit comedy. He did comedy in his 20s, and then he quit until he was like 45.
And he came back in the
game. And he did construction. He did like aluminum siding or something. And then one day he was just on the construction site. He was like, ah, I'm sick of you schlubs. I'm going back to comedy. And then he just went back to comedy.
And nails it. I love people like that.
We don't have anybody like – he would be so problematic, oh, to use the parlance, dude, of our stupid-ass times.
Right.
In today's culture.
Oh, my God. Know? He would get less respect even. Actually, you know what would happen is he'd have like some podcast where all the cool kids would listen.
That would be amazing.
And all the like outrage culture on Twitter would be like, did you hear what Dangerfield said about gays? It's like he said they're awesome. And it's like, well, no, he didn't literally say that. But through his joke, that's
right.
What he's saying.
Yeah.
Let's read some comments here. Liliana Cook. What's Dangerfield called going back to school? Oh, back to school, the best line. I mean, that's how we roll. Hope McDarby, my husband pet name I gave him is Poodle Poop.
Poodle Poop.
That's not bad. That's adorable because it has worms in it and dysentery.
What is that about? Have you ever thought about this, how you can't call the people that are closest to you, that you love, you can't call them by their real name?
No, you can't.
It's disturbing.
The idea of calling my wife Margaret is so upsetting
right.
to me.
Right, it is.
And sometimes you have to do it in public.
Yeah.
Like, you're just like,
you'd be like, Margaret.
Yeah. You feel like you have a speech impediment.
Yeah.
Like, you're stroking.
Yeah.
And she'll look at you funny. Like, huh?
Uh-huh.
Am I in trouble? Like, what's going on? Whereas if you call her, you know, Mommy Pants or mm-hmm. whatever it is the nickname is, then, you know, it's golden. You're staying golden, pony boy.
I started calling my wife is always shutting down nicknames I have for her. Because I'll just start calling her like, what's up, Little Tuna? Like, my name is not fucking Little Tuna.
Little Tuna. Oh, that's amazing. I see. I used to do that too.
I got that from The Office when Andy used to call Jim Big Tuna because he brought in a tuna fish sandwich.
This happened on a Hawaii trip when we were first dating. I started coming up with these nicknames. So I would call her, what did I call her? Mama Poop. And she's like, no, I don't answer to that. And I'm like, but you will, because that's your name now. Mama, you are Mama Poop. She's like, no, no. In fact, this relationship's over. I'm like, all right, I guess I'll back it down. By the way, Michelle Remar says, it's okay, Tom. Yesterday, a patient complained of 10 out of 10 thumb pain. So could you imagine? Like, that's like Theon Greyjoy getting flayed by, you know, by Ramsay Bolton in the Dreadfort. That's 10 out of 10.
That's anything like having a crushed thumb.
Yeah, exactly. Just take it off.
Yeah.
Just take it off. Exactly. By the way, I'm listening to Game of Thrones, the final book.
Yeah.
Trying to cram through it before it comes back live on mm-hmm. HBO. And dude, it's so different than the show. It's now diverged.
Yeah.
Like, apparently, here's just one thing. Mance Rayder doesn't actually die in the book. The Red Woman puts a spell and swaps him for the Lord of Bones, who burns up in the fire. And instead, Mance is still alive as this weird spirit, and he advises Jon Snow.
See, I don't think I'd like the books, because I like the fact that the show stripped all the bullshit out of them like that.
Yeah, know? It does get crazy.
Like, there's a one moment on the show where a shadow character kills somebody, and you're like, this is getting a little stupid. I don't know.
And in the book, it was like they just saw, you know, him die in a shadow, and that was it. It's not like out of her vagina comes this crawling black goo that then it's like, I'm going to kill, you know, Dickhole McGee. What the fuck was his name?
I forget.
It was in the Baratheon, right? It was
Renly.
Renly
Baratheon.
Renly, who was gay.
People who don't watch Game of Thrones are going to be like, what the fuck are they talking about?
There's 86 people watching us fucking talk like we talk when no one's here.
That's true.
But that's what you get for being a supporter. That's what you get, supporters. You get this. You're welcome. Heather Pages loves the books. Heather's Page, actually. Wow, there's somebody named Heather's Page.
Heather's Page.
Yeah, I think that's a nom de plume.
We used to know a guy. His name was Mac Hines Machines.
Oh, wow.
That was his name.
Wow. Speaking of Mac, Macklemore.
Macklemore.
We want to do thrift shop.
Thrift shop, that's
We're
right.
trying to think of what it is. We were thinking gift shop and do it in the hospital. Like, I'm going to pop some tags. Mama's upstairs with a stroke now.
I'm looking for a little bear that says get well soon.
And this is why these ideas never get made.
They never emerge from the
what's the word? The chrysalis that they have formed here.
The chrysalis.
They're like ready to come out, and then we're like, you're going to die now. We're going to abort this chrysalis.
You know what I love doing is I love taking words like that and making them just a little wrong. Like you'd be like, you know, it came from the chrysalis. Just where it sounds just enough
just
off.
Just enough off.
Yeah.
You know, chrysalis, the guy who rolled the stone up the hill. It's a very chrysophan.
This is another thing my wife gets mad at me about. It's just making words funnier, you know? Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Instead of saying feeding the baby, I'm like, you going to food this baby soon?
We do the same thing. You know what we do is we make fun of each other's parents' accents.
Yeah.
But then what happens is we do it so much that we just start talking like that.
You just become your parents.
You just become your parents. So this is the slow and insidious thing. So like, we'll always say, you know, like something will happen and we're at dinner and I'll be like, well, you know, you win some, you lose some. and we'll just, you know.
This is a good question, actually. You and your wife are both fairly Americanized, right?
Severely.
Because you're both from immigrant families, but you're pretty Americanized. You're very, very Americanized.
How dare you, Chief Diversity Officer? I thought I was bringing some Middle Eastern game.
And what I'm saying is, do you see any in your children, just anything from the previous generations, or are they just like standard spoiled American kids?
I think because
does anything filter down?
I guess, you know, both of them were early on. They were in a Chinese daycare in California, in the Bay Area, and they had a Chinese nanny. They spoke exclusively Mandarin at that point. So there are still these vestiges of that cultural heritage. They have no Indian at all. None.
Right.
Because even my parents are like, you better pretend you're white. That's how you get ahead in this world, okay? You two can pass, you know, for kind of off-white. Just go with that. That's what my dad used to tell me. He's like, I don't speak Gujarati in front of you because I don't want you developing an accent. I'm like, so you're going to speak accented English instead, you know? And so that was their rationale, is you got to, you know, you want to play the game. And then when you're with your people, then you're like, oh, white people, who knew? They're so crazy. There is this interesting patois, if you will, that happens when ethnic people, say in a place like the Bay Area, get together and there's no white people around. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's like, it's a kind of a reverse racism, but it's more like done out of envy.
Yeah.
Like, man, if only we were white, we could do shit like Tom Heineberg does.
I never realized I'm white until certain stuff pops up. Like recently I was asked by some lawyers who wanted to give my father a award for lawyering to come up to Vail and accept this award in a ceremony. And I was like, that's some white people shit.
Wow. Like, you have to
I'm going to go accept an award in Vail. Mm-hmm. On behalf of good lawyering. Mm-hmm.
And here's the decoder ring. And you know what? I'll tell you what. It's like that episode Mr. White with Eddie Murphy.
That's right.
On Saturday Night Live.
White Like Me is what it's called. For people who haven't seen the skit, White Like Me with Eddie Murphy is one of the greatest SNL skits of all time.
Yeah, is that the one where he goes in whiteface
and he
tries to get a loan?
When other people aren't around, white people just give each other things for free, you know? He's like, there's nobody here. Just take it. Just take the newspaper.
Just take the newspaper. No one's looking. What are you doing?
It's one of the best Eddie Murphy sketches of all time.
I
love that one.
That is tremendous. Yeah. It was one of those things where it was early on you start to realize, oh, that's what they mean when they talk about privilege. Just by looking different, the same guy gets treated differently. And it was like eye-opening to everybody, except it was obvious.
Right.
That's the best comedy. It just takes the obvious and puts it in your face.
I hate to admit it, but I think the social justice warriors are winning, because I do think that these tactics are working, because we're seeing a lot of SCDO. I see this in my line of work.
Chief Diversity Officer.
Chief Diversity Officer.
In my line of work.
In my line of work, I see a lot, you know. I think the tactics are working, because you hear a lot more conversation about privilege or whatever. Like, even amongst white people will say to each other nowadays, we'd be like, you know, it's different for us because we're white. That shit never happened.
What do you mean
we just live our lives?
Yeah,
other people are over there, for some reason they're poor, I don't know.
You know what I think? I think it's a necessary evil to transcend it, and we get all beyond it. You know, they have to go through this social justice warrior phase where people are like, okay, we've been shat on. Now we're going to overreact and do shit that's actually racist in itself.
Yeah.
Like actually discriminatory and actually creates division. But we have to do it.
Dude, there was some stat like Uncle Tom's Cabin only came out 150 years
ago. That's crazy.
Or something.
Right.
Right? Like
right.
That's insane.
I mean, there was slavery in 1860.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you could argue there were forms of indentured servitude quite a bit past that.
By the way, when you reread Uncle Tom's Cabin, I went back and read some passages recently. It's super racist.
Oh, really?
Because, you know.
Yeah, the time. Parlance of the time.
Yeah, you can't escape that. Mm. But she was saying basically, yes, these people, the woman who wrote the book was like, these people are inferior to us, which is what they all believed at the time.
Right.
But she was like, but we're still treating them like subhumans and you can't do
that. You can't do that.
Right.
Right.
And so it put a real human face on slavery, which is like, it'd talk about, you know, how the slave traders would come and pick a child out of the fields when their mother wasn't around because he's like, you know, oh, we don't want it to be a big scene, bunch of hemming and hawing. It's like, we're going to steal this child? Yeah, that was only 150 years ago, man. That's like three people ago.
Yeah, that's true. You know what I mean? Three generations. Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting about that? So when I was a kid, they had us read things like Native Son by Richard Wright, which was this book about, you know, a black guy growing up in the 20s and the kind of shit that went down. And I remember it took a book like that to get me even savvy to the nature of the suffering. Because in that story written by a black man about a black man, you could actually live that experience and go, that's what that was like. That fucking sucks. I'm not going to do that to people. But it took that. Even reading about slavery, it's hard to grok because it's so foreign now, even three generations ago, which is, again, speaks to the exponential nature of human societal progress.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But think about up until that time.
Oh, my God.
The whole world owned slaves.
Yeah.
It was normal.
Yeah.
Like, you go back, like, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, all these guys, they never mentioned slavery, and they all had slaves.
They all had slaves, yeah.
It's just like, yeah, that's, what do you mean? Of course we enslaved some people.
And that reminds me of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
The Volantines had slaves, but Westeros felt they were better than that.
This is true.
But their version of slavery in Westeros was the indentured serfdom of the medieval fief. You have your liege lord, you have the serfs, who it's the same thing, just slightly more perceived freedom.
Did I ever tell you, this reminds me of the story. Did I ever tell you the story? I was moving a couch one time to,
of course you were,
to a buddy's
Wait a
place.
Minute. I thought you had white privilege. You didn't hire someone from Home Depot to do
I
that?
Wish. I was moving a couch to a buddy's place, and we put it in the back of his truck. He was like, don't you think we need a bungee cord this time? I was like, it'll be fine. Stop being a puss. Anyway, and then we got in the car, we're driving, and I start giving this dissertation about Game of Thrones. I'm like, here's the deal, bro. If you're from Essos, people from Westeros don't give a fuck about your shit. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then my buddy's like, wait, where's the couch? And we look back, we had dropped it on the freeway. Right during the middle of this Game of Thrones diatribe.
Oh, my God, dude.
Luckily, we went back. We had not caused a 42-car pileup, so
wow,
we were in the clear. Had we, I would have kept going.
Wow.
Of course.
You know, I shudder to think what would have happened were you to launch into a dissertation about the magical properties of the wall relating to the Age of Heroes.
There are a lot of magical properties to the wall.
It's woven into the fabric. It's not just ice, yeah, Tom Heineberg.
Exactly.
Okay, and that's why when that fucking ice dragon melted that shit, okay, it started to get real.
I called that shit early on. I was like, a dragon is going to melt that wall. Of course.
Because dragonfire.
How could it be any other way?
It can't be.
R plus L equals J, son. You know what I'm saying? Rhaegar plus Lyanna equals Jon Snow. What's up? That's R plus L equals J.
You know, I see a book coming, The Math of Game of Thrones, and it's going to be a series of equations like that. Like Tyrion minus Sansa equals Dick.
Just getting off.
Did the couch survive, Rachel Kinman?
It did.
It did.
Yeah.
All right.
It got hit by a truck right behind us, we think, because it got just bounced over to the side, and then it was just only slightly damaged.
That's
That's
amazing.
It's true.
That's amazing.
We used to call that couch the hot dog couch because we got it at a Memorial Day sale at RC Willie, all the way in the back. And as part of the sale, they were offering free hot dogs for anybody who came in that day. And so the hot dog vendor was all the way in back next to the shitty couch we bought.
Oh, my God. Dude, that's, you know, we had a couch like that in college. That was college.
Yeah.
Summer Pinnock says, LOL, my baby is loving watching you too. Hello, baby. Get in my belly. Get in my belly, baby. Hello, look in my eyes, baby. That's not creepy. Oh, I'm glad our fans like bring their kids.
Can I tell you something? I feel comfortable telling the supporters this.
Oh, no.
So I'm going to therapy.
Oh, Lord.
Because I'm trying to get in touch with my feelings. And my therapist tells me to go follow this person on Instagram named The Holistic Psychologist. And Z, let me tell you, I was like, I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not following that person, but no. I went and followed him because I was like, I'm trying to do therapy. Mm. And you know what you find out when you do therapy?
Mm.
A lot of it is whack as fuck. A lot of it. So I go to this person's page, and I'm like, I'm expecting to hate this person. And I was like, you know what? She makes some compelling points. It's all about, the whole page is about, like, you know, healing your inner child. Mm. Or healing yourself is how you heal your children and stop the cycle of abuse.
Probably
and,
true.
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah.
I think I believe this.
This is the problem.
And so it's all interwoven. But what I was going to say is this, these kind of people are, you know, this person is like one step away from selling oils, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're not selling oils
right,
yet. So
right.
It's okay to follow it.
Right, right, right.
At the moment. But you know they're going to sell some oils.
They're going to sell some oils.
Because it
yeah.
starts getting, it starts like, it's like, here's the thing. Okay, there's a brain body connection between the microbiome and your feelings. And you have to, and it's like, okay, none of this is real science yet. I mean, eat good food, you probably feel healthy, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So I was having this conversation with my therapist, and she's like, what do you feel about, you know, like when you, you know, like they put glyphosate or whatever on the plants? And I was like, you mean Roundup? Yeah. Okay. I don't care about that. And she was like, well, I try and eat organic and stuff. I was like, do you eat out? She's like, yeah. I was like, how often do you eat out? Like half the time. It's like, okay. So well, you're then. Eating, you know, Roundup half the time.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
I mean,
plus by the time it's been washed and it's gotten, there's hardly any pesticides.
Just enjoy life, man.
How come people don't understand that dose makes the poison?
They don't understand it.
But also, why are these communities being underserved by medicine? Because medicine's reductionist? Or?
Because we're pretty reductionist, and I think we treat people like shit. And when we did that show with Britt Hermes talking about this, and she nailed it. Her first experience with a dermatologist, was a fucking bitch to her.
Right.
Or a dick. I forget what the gender was. And it doesn't matter, except now I'm going to fucking feel like I'm a sexist because I assumed it was a bitch.
I also think that that is sexist. you know,
By the way, Paul Duren says, Tom, all caps, does not need to get in touch with his feelings, period.
Yeah, I said about myself at one point, I was like, at this point, I either have to help a bunch of people or murder a bunch of people, and I'm still on the fence.
You know what? I was going to say that's a false equivalence, but I think it's actually an equivalence. You just flip a coin, it's going to end up the same. Except one will end with you in prison or dead.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, people are always like, why are all these males doing mass shootings? It's like, because they want status.
Yeah.
And you keep printing their name in the newspaper.
Right.
They're losers.
That's why Jacinda, you know? What's-her-head or whatever from New Zealand was like, I'm not even going to say this fucker's name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think about New Zealand banning guns?
You know, I don't. Again, I've said my piece on this in the sense that if it's codified into the Constitution and you know, it's not. Again, it's one of those deals where. Yeah, do you need an assault rifle? Well, Logan needs one because he likes to shoot rocks a lot. I think they felt better doing it. I don't think it's actually going to change a whole lot.
Right.
Yeah. So,
although they would say, and people that are liberal as fuck would be like, but what about Australia?
Yeah, but now
they took away the guns. And
they did a buyback, right?
Now people just die by a kangaroo or something.
Australia had a different culture about it. And it's, again, this culture is very different. We forget there are, like you said, it was just 3 generations ago we had slaves.
Yeah.
It was 5 generations ago that motherfuckers were telling us what to do with guns.
It's true.
And if we didn't have guns in our own militia, people would step on our shit. And I think there's still a culture that moves forward. There's a cultural inheritance. Malcolm Gladwell writes about it in his books about Southern honor. Like in the South, like you insult someone, man, it's going to come to blows and shit.
Yeah.
And that is a cultural tradition. Whereas in the North, they're just a bunch of fucking pussies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell wouldn't say this, but I'll say it.
Bitches ain't shit but hoes and tricks.
Black culture comes from that same Southern honor culture. So
really?
What we see in urban inner city ghettos comes from that same rural honor culture because, you know, white field hands and black slaves worked together and they picked up each other's culture.
Hmm.
So a lot of what we see in the inner city is honor culture stuff.
There is an honor culture for sure.
You know?
I don't, and whether that's the ideology of it or something else, it's interesting. And the question is, how do you address an honor culture when, in a scientific sense, it makes little sense now. In an evolutionary sense, it kind of makes sense. There's in-group, out-group.
Yeah,
you have to represent your tribe.
Yeah,
your family.
Think about, for all of human history, up until very recently, you lived a small life, you farm for potatoes or something stupid, and then every once in a while, other dudes would come in and kill everybody and rape your wife. And you were like, what? Gotta stop this, right?
Game of Thrones.
So it's like, if I don't know you, you're not part of the group, bro.
Yeah.
Sorry about it.
Yeah, and that's
still in our DNA.
Yeah, it's funny. As I was having this conversation, so my kids are getting smart all of a sudden. Like, suddenly they're waking up and becoming less concrete.
Getting woke.
So my seven-year-old was asking me these questions about the nature of the universe. Like, so does the universe end? And I'm like, we don't know. Well, if it does end, what's after it? I said, well, imagine three-dimensional space and a fourth dimension that a bubble is blowing up into. And she looked at me like, so we're living in a bubble. And I'm like, sort of. So then I pushed her off. I'm like, I can't answer your questions, bitch. Move on to the 11-year-old. The 11-year-old was like, so why is it that America hasn't been invaded by enemies? And I said, well, the British did it. Yeah, but it was hard and we won. Yeah, because we're separated by oceans. Well, what happened in the old days when all the continents were one? Were we all friends? And I said, this is a good question. The answer is probably not, if we existed, which we did not as modern humans. The reason is humans go through concentric – I didn't say it this way. I said humans, as they grow up, as a people, start to learn, well, first it's about your family. Then it's about your tribe. Then it's about your nation, and everyone else can fuck off. Then it's about – the whole planet, but we haven't quite gotten to that planetary level, so we're still about our tribe. And
that's when you install a one world government, and that's when all the liberals run everything. No, I'm sorry.
Exactly, Tom Heineberg. That's what we're going to do, we liberals.
I'm impressed.
Yes, we all snap like this.
You do. That's true. I'm impressed that your 6-year-old or whatever knows about Pangea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
the 11-year-old knew about Pangea. The 6-year-old knew about the universe. Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever seen the map of the continents laid out sort of this way rather than on a globe?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you can see like where the connections they all make to each other.
Bearing straight.
They're all pretty much one landmass.
They're a puzzle. Yeah. But no, Tom, the Earth is 6,000 years old.
That's true.
Ethan believes that.
If you trace back the lineages.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I am Adam.
I still measure in cubits.
Oh, me too.
It's from here to here.
Stones and cubits.
From here to here.
And that's just my dick.
Uh-huh.
The rest, I use meters because, you know, you don't want to. You have to use appropriately sized. So there was something related to that. Oh, so the youngest one, 7-year-old, was asking me, I said, oh, hit me with some more hard questions. She goes, why is it that planets float in space? Are they propelled by some rocket? What keeps them up? And I said, I had to go through the Socratic series of questions. I said, well, let me ask you a question. Why is it that we fall? Gravity? What makes gravity? I don't know. So, well, mass makes gravity. So, like, stuff makes gravity. And the bigger stuff you have, the more gravity there. So, in space, is there any stuff? No. Is there any gravity? No. So, that's why. They're not floating. They're just not falling. And then I said, wait. Because she said, then she followed up. She goes, well, why do they go around the sun? Are they rocket powered?
That's when you got to pull out the blanket. And you do the blanket demonstration, you know?
I said, there is flat, bitch. Yeah, exactly. The way I had to describe this is I said, well, the sun actually has gravity more than any of the planets. And actually, each of these planets is, I lied, there is gravity. They are falling. They're falling towards the sun. But they're also running as fast as they can because when they formed, they were already moving and there's nothing in space to stop them. So they're always falling, but never quite hitting the sun. So when you fall like this, it's called an orbit. And she just looked at me blankly. So I might not have explained it well.
You should have explained it even doper. You should be like, okay, at the beginning of time, there was two dust motes. And then
they clumped together.
And then two more clumped together. And then the mass got hot. And that's why the center of the planet is warm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Think about it.
And also
it.
F equals MA. And then you get really esoteric. Uh-huh.
And you're like, R plus L equals J.
That's right. Now, Newton said this, and he could predict this. But here's the thing. He didn't quantify for relativistic shifts. And now when we do that, we find this.
Can I tell you that one of the things I really hate, and this is something I always battle up against in therapy, is like this, like, everybody has their own truth thing, which is like, no, they don't. There's a truth, and then a bunch of dumbasses who are lying to themselves. I don't understand.
That's the Tom Heineberg approach. Objective truth exists.
There's one truth. There's one just truth. One truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't necessarily mean there's objective truth in human interaction, right? Because that's pretty subjective
right.
by its very nature.
Right.
But saying that everything is subjective truth is like having a compass and saying, well, my north is south. And I'm like, yeah, your compass is broken. And it's like, no, this is my north. You know? And it's like, no, your compass is broken, man. And it's like, no, this is my north. Anyway, bye. And then that person heads off south and they fucking die, right?
Because they're killed by penguins.
This is why it's important to align yourself with the truth so that you know where you're heading.
And I'll say this, since we're all just conscious agents interacting, experience is your own. That's your own truth. However, the way these things interact are predictable, and that is truth.
Fucking exactly.
That's science.
Exactly. That's consensus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it,
that's
maybe,
where reality forms. And you can't abstract away like the laws of thermodynamics, right?
Right, exactly.
Or the way that gravity works.
Correct.
Or,
you know. I am with you. But you could say that the way I experience this table is different than the way you experience it because my color perception is different, my sense of tactile sense is different, and in fact, my conceptual application of previous knowledge to table is different than yours. So my truth of the table is different. However, there's an objective way this table interacts with the rest of this social network of conscious agents.
Yes.
That is predictable.
100%.
With math.
Yeah, I'm never talking from my own subjective vantage point when I talk about the truth. Mm-hmm. My truth doesn't matter. I have feelings. Those are not truths, right?
Right. Well, that's
the truth is outside of me. It's not like, this is my truth, man. You know, it's out here.
Well, I would say that probably, though, you're influenced by your own truth in how you perceive your interaction with whatever the real truth is. So in other words,
yes, I'm not saying that I'm like a perfectly rational human being.
Right, right. I'm efficient market.
Yeah, I have all sorts of perceptual filters that color the way I see the world.
Right.
That said, there are truths out there, and if you get enough data points from enough, you know,
yeah,
you get the whole panopticon of everything that we can see.
Used a big word now.
And then we get the data that merges at the center point, that's probably going to be the truth most of the time.
Suzanne Anderson says, scientific evidence is a warm objective blanket in which to wrap ourselves. Yes. No, meaning I think she's being positive about scientific evidence. It's like, well, when in doubt,
yes,
there is this objective relational truth. And again, it's a relational truth. I just read an article about something called informational realism. So it basically says atoms and all that aren't real. What's real is these relationships, these numerical, like, okay, these atoms come together in a certain way, whether they're atoms or not doesn't matter. The information they contain is spin, position, this, that probability. That's real in the sense,
yeah,
that we can actually use it to make predictions about the universe. So that's great, but the thing is, none of that obviates the fact that it's all just consciousness in Hoffman's mind and in mine.
I also agree. I believe that it's probably all just consciousness,
yeah,
as well.
The other
that said, we're here and we're stuck.
Yeah.
So we do need to figure out the world.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
So that we can operate the world.
Right. If each of us is a...
Think about this. You ever think about this? The cave people, Neanderthals, had the same resources that we have today. The only thing that was different is the recipe. So they just didn't have the order of how to do things that we know through trial and error. So like, you know, grains of sand are just grains of sand to cavemen. To us, they can be silicone chips
in a glass
computer.
Or right. Glazing.
Yeah.
Well, so and that gets back to this informational realism. So they lacked the information to create what,
yes,
we have here. So what is reality? I think it's a series of strands of awareness, each of us,
yeah,
interacting in this infinite social network, evolving over time to gain more and more information about its relationship to the whole, and thereby actually changing it.
Yeah.
So we create the universe this way, and it unfolds. So that's why slavery was okay,
yeah,
in 17-something, and it's not okay now because we've actually modified our strand of thought.
And, you know, progress in civilization is really about the speed at which information flows. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting. We were talking about doing a book for a long time. Like, we were like, oh, we should do a book. And then we kind of stopped even talking about it because we were like, the podcast is the book. And you know what? I actually think that YouTube and Facebook and all the technologies that we have available at our disposal are the new printing press, and that the printed word is dying.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm starting to believe that. Because honestly, if I feel in my gut, do I want to write a book? The answer is fuck no.
It's like when you read Trump, right? Like you read Trump.
You read him,
like,
it sounds,
this guy's the dumbest person alive.
He's intellectually disabled.
And then you listen to Trump, you're like, he's kind of funny. And he's kind of making some points
it
I
makes
agree with.
The whole, like, you know, yeah. the whole thing. And he's actually, it's funny, when you hear him talk, he actually comes off as weirdly self-deprecating at
yes.
times.
Yes. No, no,
like,
no.
You're
he's,
like,
he's vaguely charming.
Vaguely charming. Yeah. Whereas in written, you're like, this guy's a megalomaniac. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something wrong. Somebody hurt him as a child.
Whereas Obama, when you would read things from Obama, you were
oh,
like,
great.
Very presidential.
Yeah, love
you
that.
Listen to him talk and be like,
I'm so
bored. Fucking bored.
I'm so bored.
Got ready to go to sleep.
Make no mistake. Somebody diddled Trump as a child.
But I think it's interesting because I think this whole thing that, you know, people are tuning into podcasts more and more and more, like mm-hmm. stuff that we're doing now and, you know, stuff that other people are doing. And I think it's the new reading. Mm-hmm. Like, I really do.
And that's simultaneously concerning and inspiring. It's funny because I looked at my 11-year-old's bookshelf today because we're moving and we're organizing all the books. And she yeah. has probably 100 books on there. And I was like, so, you know, these are just for show, right? You don't actually read all these. She's like, I've read every single book on that shelf and all the ones downstairs and all that. I'm like, so that's what you're doing in the back of the fucking car when I don't hear from you. She's always got a book and I just tune it out.
Yeah.
Bitch has read a shit ton of books. And so the question is now as she enters the world of social media, which I'm not going to let her use until, mm-hmm. but how is that going to evolve? Because she'll watch YouTube clips and she'll do these kind of things. And so is it, do you need both? I think you do.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you can consume books in millions of ways. I like audiobooks now.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Well, yeah, you have to be able to have the foundational skill of reading.
Reading, right, right, right.
Right, but, you know, for me especially, I've probably read 3,000 or 4,000 books in my
right.
lifetime. And you just find the same ideas over and over
but
again.
But you have to read the 1,000 first.
You do.
Yeah.
You do. Whereas when I'm listening to the conversations I'm listening to now online, the speed at which ideas are flying around is much faster.
Yeah.
And I'm much more engaged
yeah.
in those ideas. It feels like when I was in fourth or fifth grade and I was reading all the time.
Right, right. You know? Well, you know, I think it's partially because humans evolved a verbal storytelling tradition.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's so part of it, too.
Yeah.
In fact, it's just all storytelling if you listen to Harari. Right?
Right, yeah.
It's 100% storytelling.
It's all stories.
Money is storytelling,
money is a story.
You know, econ, everything we
That's
do.
Right. Actually, Peterson has said that too. And others have said that too. And it's interesting because the people who say that typically fall into this intellectual dark web of, you know, elite philosophers. But in reality, it's just common sense.
Yeah, although people will use it, like Taleb will use it as, he calls it scientism, where it's like, you're not really a scientist. You're you're telling the story
the
of
story
science.
Of science.
That's your story.
Yeah. You know, in a way, I hate to say this, but that's what our platform does.
A little bit.
Yeah. We tell the story of science. And the reason is if we told the raw science, there'd be a group that are into that. But there are plenty, like people like Peter Attia, he tells the raw science. He doesn't
right.
tell the story of science. He's a maven. So he cares about this knowledge.
Yeah.
Whereas I care about people learning to be better in the world
right.
from a medical standpoint or otherwise.
And I care about everybody getting their fucking compasses to true north. That's
there you
what
go.
I care about. Whatever you do with your compass, I don't care.
Yeah.
But I want your compass to be aligned correctly before you head out into the woods.
And that's why we make a decent team. Let's
you know
look at
saying?
These supporter comments. Let's see. Love the smell of a book. Can't get that from a Kindle. Sensory memories are there, Stephanie Miranda. And that's what my daughter, she won't do Kindle.
Yeah, Kindle kind of sucks.
Yeah,
I have
does.
A Kindle paper white or whatever the hell. And
yeah.
The one that's more bookish than the
yeah,
regular
yeah,
Kindle.
Yeah, right, right.
And I still don't like it that much.
Now, books are better for
yeah.
yeah.
It's good for like the beach or something.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to travel and take a bunch of books. You know, then it's good.
Then it's good, yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, traveling. Katie Hodak, as usual, all Z talks boil down to consciousness. Love it.
It's true.
Some people don't. Some people get very fucking triggered when I start talking about that shit. It's funny, when we were doing the Beta Brand thing, I started talking about meditation, consciousness.
Yeah.
I was watching the audience. Because, see, normally when I do these things, there's no fucking audience. It's
right.
a virtual audience.
Right.
I see comments and they're like, you're crazy. Oh, you high. What's going on?
But you're reading the room now and you're like,
now
oh.
I'm reading the room and I'm watching their faces glaze over and start to look at their watches. And I go, oh, it's interesting. So, and I think it's partially because for even me to get to the point of thinking of this stuff had to be a huge process.
Oh.
A huge process of like, what
yeah.
am I? Yeah, have your middle-age crisis, start to meditate, do some psychedelics. You know, you had to go
yeah.
through the whole process.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you're not there, you're asking, it's like some weird alien coming and saying, you know, bleak a shikabla da da da. And you going, well, of
meditation
course.
Is entirely frustrating.
Yeah,
also.
It can be.
You know,
I've went, and it goes through phases.
Yeah.
You know, me, I'm like an tireless advocate of meditation. I, for the last month, probably took like 4 days off at a time meditating. I hadn't done it because I just got fed up. I hit this wall where I was like, it's wasting an hour of my day and nothing's getting better.
Fucking
shit. And then I started noticing that I was unraveling a little bit.
Yeah.
So then I started meditating in a slightly different approach. Instead of an hour, I did 30 minutes. And at the end of 30 minutes, I would listen to one lesson one day from Sam Harris's Waking Up app.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's been transformative. So like now I – first of all, it's much more focused, and then the rest of the day I'm infused with this sense that Sam gives you because he's a teacher. So what I needed at this point was a teacher. So what I'm saying is there isn't one answer, and it evolves over time, and if you get frustrated, that's okay. It's normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to meditate just for a state change in my brain, you know? So I can refire my brain in a different way.
It's really what Atiya said when he was talking about meditation on the show. He said it's not meditation is not for how you feel in that moment.
Mm-mm.
It's like when you exercise. Yeah. You don't exercise to feel like shit when you're exercising. You exercise for the other 23 hours that you feel better for.
Yeah.
And I think that's the goal of meditation ultimately.
Yeah, I also think meditation is just people think it's supposed to be like this Zen. Like when you start talking about it and people's eyes glaze over, they think it's like, what? I'm supposed to go sit in a cave and fucking like Zen out. Like, bitch, I got kids. I got bills to pay, right? Yeah. Whereas I think the actual truth of meditation is, it's just like taking your hand off a hot stove, which is just like, hey, you're getting addicted to being angry or sad or, you know, OCD or anxious or whatever it is. And you need the tool to be able to take your hand off that stove.
Right.
It's very simple and prescriptive.
And it's interesting because I had blown off Sam Harris's app thinking I don't need this because I'm using the Mind Illuminated. I'm going through this thing. I'm a moderate meditator. Not true. Sam has been on a collective 2 years of silent retreat, and he is an articulate communicator of the fundamental truth of the meditation style he's teaching, which is this. You are a field of awareness in which your personality, your sense of self, your emotions, your mood all arise.
Right.
But you aren't those moods. You aren't those thoughts. And punctuating your day by making these little mini realizations changes everything.
Yeah.
So instead of getting lost in thought, lost in an emotion, angry, frustrated, you can go, oh, for a second, no, I'm just I'm aware of these things. And actually, as this fundamental awareness, I'm eternal. I can't be fucked with. I can't be colored. I can't be moved.
Yeah.
And everything else just happens. And he said this, which I thought was spot on. Consciousness experiences the world as you. So this you, this constructed self that is this dynamic system of sub-minds interacting with itself and others, is awareness's way of seeing the world. And it's seeing it through your eyes. But your eyes are not a thing in themselves. They're a mechanism through which awareness has experience. So when you do that, you let go of all this, I am this person, I am this ego, I am this. But again, it's hard. It's weird.
It's super hard.
Yeah. And to even not, just what to, I just said is going to lose like 70% of the
audience. Oh, yeah. But, you know, it doesn't have to be as woo-woo as people make it. It can literally just be, you know, I'm furious and I'm about to fucking throw a chair through a window.
Right.
And what I'm going to do is now I'm going to move that anger over here and it's going to, me and it are going to coexist in this moment. I'm going to be like, what are you doing? Why are you so angry, man? What are you angry about? You know?
Yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't throw a chair through a window. Maybe you should just step back. And just having that split second of pause.
That's all it takes.
That's all it takes to dissipate it almost entirely.
And Harris has this line, too, that he says, how long can you stay angry without getting lost in thought? In other words, without identifying with the anger.
Yeah.
If you see anger arising and recognize, like you said, oh, shit, I'm about to throw this chair. Now, first of all, who's this I? Well, it's this feeling that I have that I want to throw this chair. Oh, okay. What happens if I just watch? Oh, the anger just dissipates.
Yeah.
It can't last for more than a few seconds.
But if you hang on to
it. It lasts for days.
It's like holding onto a hot stone and waiting around a corner to throw it at somebody else.
Yeah.
And maybe that person's coming around the corner. Maybe they're not. Right. We all know that feeling, which is like, I'm going to hang on to this anger so nobody ever hurts me again because really I'm small and I'm sad.
Exactly. Hey, well, here's the thing, though. We have to forgive that bundle of thoughts because it evolved for a reason. Like that anger
keeps
was very
safe.
Productive, right? Because otherwise you trust everyone, you're open. These things are dangerous in a tribal community where you're always in danger. So you're not going to, as a strand of thought, you're not going to pass on a baby strand of thought to the universe because you're going to be dead.
Totally.
And by dead, this is my theory on death. This is going to I'm going to lose all the audience. My theory on death is if we're a collection of these conscious agent subminds that sum up to our level of experience and they're feeding us data. So a thought is a discriminating mind feeding us data into this conscious awareness that we then perceive. But even that little submind is aware and full of subminds itself. Mm. When we die, this confederation of subminds dissolves into its primary parts, each of which remain conscious, but then they are reassembled into, you know, another consciousness later, as just as atoms are. So instead of thinking atoms, think experience and conscious agents. So what's a child? A child is sort of the flow of your consciousness creating, and it, the word karma is used here in that it is causes and conditions that you put into motion that end up in your child, which is another strand of consciousness that evolves out subminds into a awareness. And in a way, that is the immortality of that strand that started with you. But even if you die without children, you're still just part of this bigger awareness, just dissolved out. So you don't have this level of awareness, but there are sub-awarenesses, and then you may be part of a bigger awareness that you cannot access when you're, you know, trapped in this.
Right.
So I, you know, I think death is an illusion.
And when in the Buddha, you know, I'm trying to think about this, in the cycle of life in Buddhism, desire is the cause for reincarnation. So maybe you desire to come back as this type of subjective experience. Like you want to reassemble as these conscious agents.
Right.
And maybe you're allowed to do that throughout time. You know, like you ever heard the thing, like you live the same life until like you get it right. You know?
Right. Well, I wonder. And
maybe
I wonder,
it just recycles over and over again. So, like, so that we live in an infinite loop.
Because this idea of that reincarnation is a troubling one from a scientific perspective. But what about from a conscious agent perspective? It's what you're saying. So this question of like you're allowed to implies a higher deity that's saying you can do this and these are the rules. And
yeah.
What if it's more, these are just, we were talking about science.
In reincarnation, there's no higher deity. You're the highest deity.
You are the highest deity. Yeah. So what it is it's this like a river flowing of experience and conditions and actions.
Have I told you about the Tibetan Book of the Dead? You've never read it, right?
I've never read it, but you told me a little about
it. So in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, basically what happens is you die, right? And then you meet God. That's the very first thing that happens. Hmm. And when you meet God, God is the all, all of consciousness.
Right.
It's overpowering.
Right.
And if you cower, you get kicked back down, basically, to live again. And you go to either a heaven, if you lived a good life, like sort of a nice place between lives, or you go to a hell, sort of a terrible place between lives. And neither is a permanent state. So if you're Hitler, you're in hell for a long time, but not permanently. Mm. If you're a good person, you lived a good life, maybe you're Mother Teresa or something, you live in heaven for a long time, but not permanently. And it's kind of based on your own desires. Do you want to stay in heaven? Do you want to stay in hell? How do you get out of it? But if when you meet God, you realize, I am God. That is me. I am part of the all. We are all the all. Mm. Then you transcend, and that's nirvana.
That's nirvana.
That's enlightenment.
That's the end of the karmic cycle.
Right.
Right.
If you choose the cycle of reincarnation of life and death, you go back down. You spend a little time in heaven or hell. When you get out of heaven or hell, you go to this sort of series of caves, and you are, and I'm saying, this is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I'm not saying I necessarily believe this.
Right.
This is what's in their religion.
This is their mythology, yeah.
This is Tibetan Buddhism. This is what's in their religion. Although, as somebody who's done a lot of drugs, it makes a lot of sense. and you get kicked back down, and then you go through these series of caves, and the Godhead, your higher self, the all, is basically giving you instructions on which cave to choose from. And you choose a cave based on the kind of life that you want to live and the lessons you want to learn and maybe what you're hoping to get out of things, and then you go into that cave, and then you fucking come out, and you're a brand new baby because each of those caves is a womb, and that's what happens in the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
So, see, if any of that's true, it is purely a metaphorical way that humans can wrap their brain around what's actually happening with conscious agents. In my mind,
we could never know if those things are true,
right?
Because it's those that happens elsewhere,
right? And who can tell us? Who can come back and tell us?
Who can
right?
come back and tell
now,
us?
Now, the Christians will say, well, Jesus came back and told us. But see, here's the thing. Here's how I see God. And Donald Hoffman agrees with me because he came up with this idea, probably on the shoulders of others, which is if according to the math, his theories, conscious agents sum up to higher levels of consciousness that we don't directly access, although we might get glimpses when you're at a game like a Golden Knights hockey game and everybody's synced and they're all watching this one person together emerges out a higher level of cohesion and awareness.
Right.
So God is the highest level where everything in the universe
is synced.
And in that mind, we can't access it. But imagine what that experience is like. And that's people who have transient connection with that state come back as mystics. They're like, I talked to God and he told me this shit right here. Yeah. So we should stop being dicks to each other because guess what? We're all one. Well, that's what pretty much everybody says. So there's probably some truth that we're getting at with these mystical experiences that are really just synchronizations with these higher, confluence of subminds.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And anybody who's done a shitload of drugs will tell you that.
Oh, fuck, man. We pretty much crushed this podcast, Tom Heidelberg.
We've kind of gotten, we've kind of gotten rid of mystical experience from like the Bible and the Judeo-Christian,
the burning bush and these things that were mystical experiences.
Those are mystical experiences. Right. I mean, the burning bush is obviously drugs. It's obviously drugs.
That DMT.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was like, what was the ancient psychedelic they used to have? Soma. Which was sort of this, I think
also
it was Egyptian Huxley. Culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And nobody knew quite what it was, but it's probably some sort of ergot fungus, like LSD type substance, as a kombucha type drink, whatever it was.
Yep.
And I think everybody should just do more drugs, man.
I'm with you. Jody Houghton says, good morning. I just finished a hospice death visit and I turned this on, LOL. God talks to me. He used you to speak to me. Thanks, guys. Love that you do this. Now on to the next patient.
Being in a hospice room is a very different experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt as mystical being in like a church. I always felt like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm so bored. Get me the fuck out of this church, right? But when you're in a hospice ward, it's sort of like hallowed ground. And you walk around and the whole place, it feels mystic.
Anybody who works hospice, any nurse who's dealt with death, any doctor who's had to pronounce someone or be there at the end of life has felt this. And it's real. Like, it's a real thing. Now, the question is it just our cultural expectations around death and a mysticification of death? And no, I think it's actually.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You're there resonating with another dynamic system of consciousness that is going through this epic event.
When I was, when I was in hospital, like if you're going to be a reductionist about it and say that, the body and then it stops and then you die and then that's it. And then it's like a computer and the brain just turns off. That's not true.
Yeah.
because when I was in hospital with my father, he should have died 6 days before he died. And like the body was gone and all the nurses kept coming up to me and being like, are you going to sleep here tonight? Because you should sleep here tonight. Mm. And so, I'd stay there until like 1-2 a.m. and I'd be like, I don't think he's going to pass tonight. And I'd go home. He'd be alive the next day.
Mm.
And I did that like every day for 6 days because all the nurses were convinced his mind was hanging on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he wasn't ready to leave yet. That's how strong the mind is.
I'm a full, it took me years to get to this state of like, anti-reductionism about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, in a way, I'm a reductionist. Everything is made out of one-bit conscious agents interacting with each other, exchanging experience. But that's as reductionist as I get.
Think about that, though. Like, of course, how could you have complex structures if they didn't have very simple rules that they followed?
And I actually don't think they're infinite all the way down. I think there is a lower...
The big problem with Hoffman's theory is you can't measure it.
Yeah.
You'll never be able to measure it.
Yeah, not yet. Although I bet there'll be clever AI-driven ways to actually measure the conscious agent theory because you can start to make predictions based on his math and go, okay, one way to measure it is if from his formulas about conscious agents interacting, can you derive quantum mechanics, relativity, and basic chemistry, Newtonian physics. If you can, then it's more likely to be true than any other theory. And again, all theories are only approximations.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you know the story about the dude who invented the microscope? I forget his name. But
His name was Mike Roscope.
He was, I think he was Scottish or English or whatever. And so he sent in a thing to the, Scottish Society of Science or the British Society of Science, whatever it was. And he was like, guys, you're not going to fucking believe this shit. So here's the deal. There are small animals living in the water. And people were like, what the fuck
Holy
are you
shit.
Talking about?
It's like when I talk about this stuff.
They sent him back a letter basically being like, you're drunk. Shut the fuck up. you know? And then he showed up with the microscope and he was like, look at it.
Yeah.
It's right. So maybe when we get to like whatever can measure consciousness, we're going to be like, this is insane. Yeah, take it back. I don't want to know if there's invisible conscious agents all over me.
You know the problem? You know? See, this is the microscope for consciousness, meditation. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you can't just turn on a light and have anyone look at it. It takes a fucking shit ton of work.
Right.
Unless you're a savant. And that's the problem. So anybody who's an adept meditator will tell you, yeah, this feels right. Anyone I've talked to who's like done, you know, is I know a doctor who's a Zen Buddhist, spent years in on silent retreats, done all this. And when I showed him Hoffman's theory, he's like, yeah, of course, that's exactly right. Feels as about as right as my empiric experience through meditation would tell me.
Yeah. As soon as you told it to me, I was like,
yeah, you were like,
as a
right
person
away.
Who's done DMT and mm-hmm. gone to the other side, it's real.
It's real.
I feel it.
But now I think the vast majority of people look at you like you're insane.
Yeah,
which is okay. That's all right. I won't only cry myself to sleep certain days of the week. I've given that to myself. Speaking of which, I have to go meet a fucking real estate agent.
Lame.
I know, because I have to sell my house.
Lame.
It's super lame, dude.
Lame. I'll buy your house, bro. How much is it up for?
$5, $6. What do you think? Plus, like, take me to Chipotle.
Let's go to that McDonald's across the street. You can have any five items off the
holy
dollar
shit,
menu.
Holy shit, off the dollar menu?
Yeah.
What about tax?
You know, it used to be my thing. I would tell girls when I take them out, they'd be like, "Where are we going?" I'd be like, "We're going to McDonald's. You can have any three things off the dollar menu. If you're good, you can have a dessert."
That sounds like Vader. And if you're really good and you worked especially hard, we'll have a dessert.
I wonder who writes half the Vaders.
One dessert split four ways.
I wonder if people know how much of my insane thinking ends up in the Doc Vaders.
Oh, it's clear. It's clear.
All the medical stuff is Z, but if you ever hear a pop culture food reference, that's me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's Tom Heineber.
I'm like, here's the thing. Those biscuits, though.
All right. Where are we? We got to go.
Yeah.
It's been how long?
Speaking of pop culture food references, I'm going to leave you all with this. Long John Silver's is whack as fuck.
Oh, fuck.
Who thought about fast food fish? Dude. And why do they have hush puppies instead of fries? What? You ever heard of fish and chips, you dumb motherfuckers that run this restaurant? Fuck you, Long John Silver's.
Go learn from the British. They had it right the first time. And fuck all y'all hoes, Long John Silver's. Actually, we love you supporters. Thank you for everything you do. Spread the word about this. The supporter tribe is now the official cool place to be because we ain't going to give this shit to the main page, although it will be a podcast because why not? All right. Fuck all y'all. I love you. We out. Peace.
Thumbnail.
The thumbnail. It's just me. Here, let's do it here. Wait, the wrong camera. Wrong camera.